Hello. Greetings and welcome to New Horizon, the Mind and Body Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Keisha Ross. It is Sunday, April 24th. We've got a great show for you today. We have Dr. Ro Meeks with us. Before we get into our topic today, psychological science related to community health. My community stresses me out. I'll just give you a bit of background about Dr. Meeks and then we will get right into it. Rome D. Meeks earned a Doctor of Philosophy, PhD, at Michigan State University, where he is currently serving as Professor of Human Development. Dr. Meeks' practice is focused on organizational and community development, restorative practices, and program evaluation. His research interests include the neurological effects of stress in poor urban environments, systems, science change initiatives, equity versus equality, and African American identity development. Dr. Meeks is the co-founder and executive director of Panidaso 360, an organization that educates, empowers, and equips young men and women of color spiritually, culturally, and professionally, and a psychology professor, as we mentioned earlier, at Michigan State University. Welcome, Dr. Meeks. How are you doing today?
Well, thank you for having me here. You know, today I'm actually doing really well. I'm here in Michigan, and today we had 70 degrees yesterday.
Wow. 80.
Now, nice. That may not mean a whole lot, but last week it was snowing, and, you know, we're in April, right? And so
yes.
I'm doing well.
You got to take the nice weather when it comes. So, absolutely. So happy you could be here today. I'm excited for you to talk about this topic. We've talked a great deal about mental health and various aspects, and we focused a great deal on treatment. So today we're going to really get into the importance of research in terms of psychological science. So we are excited for you to talk about the role of psychologists in terms of research. So let's get right into it and start with you discussing psychologists as researchers. Please discuss some of your research for us.
Thank you. Such an important topic. You know, many people have probably heard of this research to practice gap, right, in different spaces. And so we need evidence-based research that informs the work that we do. And I believe that I'm both. Actually, I don't believe. I am both and really passionate about both research and practice. So broadly speaking, I am a systems change scientist and researcher, which means I focus on a broad array of topics. So when you were giving my introduction, I focus on quite a bit of different things, really looking at how systems influence behavior. Often when we think about psychologists, we think about one who is really looking at behavior. But for me, I'm really trying to understand how systems in which we're embedded in, how those systems influences our behavior. And so those systems we know often come together because of different principles or procedures according to what we're supposed to do to some outcome, mm-hmm. whether that's in school, within organizations, et cetera. And so I'm looking at those organizations. I'm really interested in understanding and improving where people live, work, and where they play. And that includes looking at community deficits, but not only on those deficits, really looking at the assets as well. We often overlook the many assets that people have and the communities that also have many assets within them. I research effective ways to talk about inequities with solutions for equitable changes, equitable outcomes, and as you mentioned, research the effects of racial ethnic identity development. According to research, it is around the age of 12 that people come to this idea of awareness for who they are, their racial ethnic background. And sometimes if they're not steered in the right direction, it can cause a lot of confusion. And so that's just another area that I really focus on as well and believe that all of these areas can really change and transform our communities, especially when we know who we are.
Wonderful. Well, you're doing a lot. I'm so excited that you're here to talk with us about it. But, you know, as you mentioned earlier, just to recap, you're working on like evidence-based type of treatment. And in the world of psychology, that just means like our gold standard, right? We're doing research. You know, we have evidence to show that these type of treatments work. And as you also mentioned, you're focusing on systems. So those larger areas of change, which we know will impact individuals, will impact communities also, because larger systems is, as you say, where we live, we play, we work, you know, we get our education, where we get our healthcare, all of that is within a system. And then you brought us home talking about like identity development and really working on having messages for that. So talk with us about what you were mentioning in terms of inequities. Talk with us about closing the gap in mental health care. What does your research point to?
Yeah, as a start, research suggests that there is this gap with mental health services, particularly for various demographics, particularly those that are minorities. And for my research in particular, there are really four A's, or what I talk about as the four A's to really closing any service-oriented gaps, particularly in mental health services. The first A is affordability. Can people afford them? What does it cost? The other is availability. What is the extent to which the resource is actually available, right? And to whom, in what communities, et cetera. So we have affordability, availability. The next is accessibility. To what extent can the client actually access what might be available, right? And so after we talk about accessibility, the other is it actually adequate? So does it meet the individual needs? Are there individuals that are trained in what I might need them to be trained in, right? If I'm experiencing trauma, can I find someone that focuses on trauma, or if it's abuse, or if I want someone who is of a particular religious background, as you know, I am, can I find that? So it might be affordable, it might even be available, but it might not be accessible, and it surely might not be adequate for my needs. And so I think really focusing on the four A's can really help to lessen, right, or close this gap with mental health services.
I love that. So let me recap for our listeners. Affordability, the four A's, affordability, availability, accessibility, and adequate. And we've talked a great deal in previous shows about cultural competency, and we'll get a little bit into that as well. So again, are people trained to work with specific communities? Do we understand historical trauma, intergenerational, transgenerational trauma, how that impacts both physical and mental health, how people cope. So I love hearing all of that. And that's the way you summed it up. It is wonderful. So tell us a bit more, though, about some of the challenges faced by Black people in urban areas. As you talked about availability and accessibility, talk with us about urban areas.
Yeah, thank you. And so I think what I would like to do is, as I mentioned these things, to ask people that they still, you know, have in their minds the four A's, right, as working with people in poor urban communities or Black people specifically. When thinking about these four A's, unfortunately, Black people in urban areas experience these things at increased risks, right? And so while there are great skills and assets that I believe are really important to focus on, there are challenges. There are challenges specifically around the healthcare system and how one is able to access them. Representation matters. People often in these environments don't see people who look like them. And while we're not to assume that everyone has the same experiences, we do know that one, representation matters, and being culturally aware of others' needs is important, and that often goes unlooked. we know that there are challenges within the educational system. There's challenges within law and government, mm-hmm. food systems, et cetera. There's an economic challenge that Black people experience. There yes. are physical challenges. And so, unfortunately, the list goes on. There are two things that I would like to talk about with this. One is we've probably heard of social determinants of health, right?
Yes.
And with social determinants of health, there are particular systems that affect our health. Those include economic stability, social and community context, the neighborhoods in which we're in, and mm-hmm. the healthcare or educational system. Now, when we think about social determinants of health, there are also social determinants of equity. Now, social determinants of equity, they look at what is the accessibility or affordability of the health and local foods, the access to health and prevention, recreational parks, efficient transportation, housing, the safety of housing. Mm-hmm. And so when talking about the social determinants of equity, for Black people in urban environments, those particular areas, the accessibility and affordability are challenges that Black mm-hmm. people actually experience to greater rates than those in other communities. And so it's important that we're able to think about that when thinking of how we close the gap for either mental health services or other services that Black people are not able to have access to.
So thank you for highlighting those social determinants we've discussed on many episodes, because it's the thread, right? If we don't make a shift, we won't make a change. But I love that you are looking at the response, right? In terms of, we identify the problem, but as you said, you know, what are the social determinants of equity? What are the things that we can do? So as you mentioned, affordability and accessibility, I just think of the pandemic, COVID. You know, we still see challenges now, but definitely in the beginning, you know, we've had more time now, but we saw that, you know, Black communities, Latin, Indigenous, you know, those communities were hit at a higher level. And because of those areas that you discussed right there, like what was the accessibility even to be tested? You know, there weren't testing. I'm in St. Louis and, you know, we have a lot of like predominantly Black urban areas, and testing was not available in those areas. Then when the vaccine came about, there were people driving like hours to go to other places to get the vaccine because it was not available within their community. So what you talk about there is so important. And, you know, last week we talked a little bit about the nutritional base. So the food desert, so not having live food, so also having that level of deficiency that's going to impact mental health, ability to concentrate, focus. So we see with children in schools, there's an impact.
Yes.
So the more we focus on those social determinants of equity to close those gaps, as we talk about, we can see the equity rising. So thank you for breaking that down.
For sure. And it's, you know, it's not because of COVID, right, that these things become problematic. Mm-hmm. COVID just helped to uncover, right, the inequities that these communities are already experiencing.
It was so amazing because, you know, I'm a Black woman and I know these things that exist. I've experienced it, but something about COVID, it just stripped away any false pretenses, any kind of, you know, illusion that might have been there, because you could so clearly see those who could, you know, shelter in place. Mm-hmm. You know, we saw the different levels in terms of work and career fields, those who had to take public transportation. So we just saw it so clearly. Like, I think it just added a magnifying glass, right, to what was already there. So in terms of your research, it's helping to look at a lot of, you know, the solutions for these problems. Talk with us about some of, before we get to even more to problem solving, talk with us about the neurological effects of stress in urban areas.
Yeah, Dr. Ross, there's so much there. You know, I often like to start with the fact that the neurological effects that we experience, particularly for those that are Black and brown and living in poor urban environments, it starts in utero. So even mm-hmm. before you're born,
yep.
you might have some challenges because of your mother, right? Your mother mm-hmm. who's experiencing high levels of stress.
Yes.
We know, according to research, that women in general that are experiencing stress, they don't even have to be living in a poor urban environment, but Black mm-hmm. women particularly, because of the stress that they're experiencing, are more often than others to have children that have low birth weights, mm-hmm. right? And then those low birth weights can affect the development of a child. Now, good thing is that one can make some changes. It doesn't have to debilitate them. And so that's a great thing. And what's exciting about our brain is that our brain is very, the term that we often use is plastic, right? It can yes. change. And so mm-hmm. we're grateful for that. And so in urban environments, individuals are often exposed to a number of stimuli at increased levels. So in urban environments, it often plays on all of our senses. Mm-hmm. So all of them, what we see, what we smell, what we touch, what we hear and taste, our senses are on high alert.
Yeah.
And so what do I mean? What I mean by that is that in urban environments, we often are exposed to louder noises. Those mm-hmm. noises can be due to the constant influx of sirens, whether they're police sirens, whether they are emergency mm-hmm. sirens. We often hear more shooting of guns, mm-hmm. right? We see dilapidated buildings.
Yes.
Buildings are often still because no one's really maintaining them well. There's often still lead in the paint. We can think mm-hmm. about Flint here in Michigan. There's mercury in the water, right? And so all of our senses are really being tested and on high alert. Mm-hmm. Well, if our senses are on high alert, then there is a physiological response to the body and the brain. And what happens is that there is then a release of hormones, and those hormones we know are known as cortisol, right? Mm-hmm. And cortisol at very high levels, they can be toxic to our bodies. And so high levels of cortisol makes it difficult for our bodies to do several things, which can include fight infection. It often increases weight. And so if we have difficulty with weight, that could be contributed to high levels of stress, not getting enough sleep. If we're living in environments where noise is high, then that makes sense. There's often health challenges with increased cardiovascular diseases. We know, unfortunately, yes. that Black people are at the top of, you know, cardiovascular diseases and dying for them at really high rates. But neurologically speaking, it rewires the brain when we have these different experiences.
Yes.
Now, I put a pause there because I think that it's important that while it rewires the brain, that while some researchers in the past have tried to state that it makes us academically inferior or something is wrong with our brain, that is absolutely not the case.
Say it again.
Yes, that is not the case. We are very intelligent and smart and can do anything above yes. and beyond anyone else. But it does rewire the brain, and the way in which we process information will probably look quite differently than maybe those in a dominant society, because they're not processing information or taking in information mm-hmm. in the same ways that we are. A real example of that is if we're always experiencing, right, these loud noises, gun violence, dilapidated buildings, all those things, what can often happen is that we become overly stimulated. And when we become overly stimulated, we might become desensitized to certain things. Doesn't yes. mean that we're not being impacted by those things, but the way in which we process those things and experience them, they look a little bit differently than others. And so we have to do a lot of work when it comes to thinking of how we best help children and then adults to process information if those that have lived in predominantly poor environments for a mm-hmm. long period of time, we have to think differently on how we're able to help them process information and receive the things that they need to be able to excel and do the things that anybody else can do.
Wow, you just said it all. I mean, and it's so important to understand, because living while Black or brown, in particularly in this country, people really have to understand the science. And that's what you're breaking down, is that there is an impact on the brain, neurological effects. And when you talked about starting in utero, you know, it makes me think of how important prenatal and perinatal care is. You know, Black women have 3 times more maternal mortality rate than our white counterparts. We saw what happened with Serena Williams. And think about it, right? She's wealthy.
Yes.
She's a celebrity. She's known. So that means it still doesn't inoculate you from racism, which is important, I think, for particularly white counterparts to understand, because there might be that belief, oh, well, you know, if they just educate themselves and if they just, you know, get to a certain place that, you know, they'll be better. But as you talk about with systems, we still are impacted by these systems. And as you talked about in utero, it makes me think just about the transgenerational piece. So we're thinking one generation just now, but when we think transgenerationally in terms of 400 plus years of oppression, imagine, you know, all of the stress that we have been under as a people and how that has impacted us over time. So there's so much we need to do in the here and now that are part of our daily lives, but also that aspect of that ancestral piece in terms of how we have been impacted.
If I may, I think what you just said there about the generational piece is so important, because even according to research, more often than not, the socioeconomic status in which we are in is indicative of the same economic status in which our parents were in, and then their parents were in, right? And so poverty is cyclical, and a lot of those within our families have probably experienced poverty. Now, thankfully, we all don't have to stay there in poverty, and this is just a generalization. We know that people leave and are moved to opportunity. But generally speaking, individuals will be within the same environment in which their parents were in, and then their grandparents, right? And so these generational effects, as you mentioned, are passed down from generation to generation. And then that affects our psyche, right? How we think about things, how we do life, all those things influence who we can become.
And as you mentioned that, we have to have the buffering effects. I think about even the talk, right? We have to raise our children differently. My daughter's only 8, but we still already have conversations, right? Because you've got to start early, as you said, because research shows the best buffer against racism is, you know, a healthy racial socialization, a healthy identity of self, who one is in terms of their racial, ethnic, cultural makeup. But even as we educate, there's that still that level of trauma. So we can imagine, you know, those who were living in the generation of like lynching occurring, and, you know, people that I work with who, you know, they talked about their grandfather like surviving lynching or grandfather having been lynched. So these are stories that are told, well, be careful going in these areas because this is what can happen. So there is that level of vicarious trauma, even in terms of helping to protect, you know, our families and who we are. So it's finding that balance in terms of what can we do for self-care. So I think it's important you're here today and talking about research. And I want our listeners, particularly our Black listeners, to understand it's important to be a part of research, because research often excludes us, right? Yes. The medical model is based on a white, Eurocentric, often most healthy type of model. Mm-hmm. So because we are already exposed to so much type of stress, as you mentioned, some of the research, it's not going to take into account how a medicine might impact us, how a psychological treatment might impact us. But due to historical trauma and the form of medical experimentation, many people of color, particularly Black people, are suspicious of being part of research or clinical trials. Can you speak to the need and reason for our participation in trials, Dr. Meeks?
Yes. I'll start with saying representation matters, right? And often when we think about representation, we might get the visualization of that being in schools. We know that having a Black teacher matter, right? If I am also Black, or if I'm, yes, you know, female, having a female teacher matters. Mm-hmm. So representation matters, whether it's in school, business, healthcare, et cetera. It matters. And so if it matters in those environments, representation also matters in research and clinical trials. Yes. The reasons why they also matter in these settings, you know, the idea of cross-cultural comparisons, and I think you mentioned it. Unfortunately, in most studies, Black, Indigenous, and other people of color often have to be compared to the white society, right? Yes. And everything might not correlate with the white dominant group, but that's who we always, as people of color, have to mm-hmm. be compared to in lots of different studies. Now there's a terminology that you may have heard of that calls it weird science, right? Where we are comparing others to the weird population. And so we can't always look at that as being the norm. And so mm-hmm. when it relates to representation in research and clinical trials, it helps because now, as a person of color, I can say I know someone that's experienced a particular, you know, or been a part of a particular clinical trial. I know that it works for them, as opposed to saying those racial socialization messages that, oh, that only works for white mm-hmm. people, or that only works for these particular groups of people, because now I know someone, or even myself, right, that's been a part of a randomized controlled experiment or trial. And so then I can say that, and it matters. It also then would lessen or decrease the bias that's associated yes. with science, because once again, I'm connected to the research. I understand the science. I know others within my community that also understand the research and science, and they've actually been a part of it, right? I'm not just hearing yes. it from the dominant group, but we're a part. And so we can look at the effects of, you know, these different clinical trials, looking at the effects of mental health services, how it helps those within our community, et cetera. And so representation matters for a lot of areas. Now, we do know that in our past and even our current, we often talk about our past, right, as it relates to the trauma that we've experienced around clinical trials. And I think we sometimes do a disservice by always talking about the past trauma that we've experienced around clinical yes. trials, because we've experienced current trauma in clinical trials or within the healthcare system yes. generally, right? And it's because we don't have the representation, I believe, mm-hmm. that's needed in these different spaces for us, once again, to see, to feel, and touch those that look just like we do, to know that they're also involved in the science, in, you know, the mental health mm-hmm. trials, in these ethical trials that are really important. And then lastly, there are some biases, right? But what's really important, particularly when thinking about our conversation before around the neurological effects of stress, people of color often have a double disadvantage. And that double disadvantage is that one is experiencing the increase of stress solely because of who they are and what they look like, right? Discrimination, mm-hmm. prejudice, and those things. But then added onto that is the effect of living in these poor urban environments.
Yes.
And so it's this double disadvantage. And so we must be a part of these, you know, medical trials to really move, you know, mm-hmm. things forward for us, so that we are represented in the science. We have stories to share about how we have overcome in a positive way.
Yes.
And we're involved in the science that we are also a part of, right, as scientists.
Thank you so much for the research that you do. And as you said, representation matters in this field of research. So it's important for our listeners to understand, as you said, I think when research is heard, they only think of the dominant culture. And it's important that we have many BIPOC, Black, Indigenous, people of color during research, and it's growing. There's so much in the field of race-based traumatic stress, so much looking at, you know, transgenerational impacts, what you're looking at the neurological effects. So it does help to decrease a bit of the stigma to know, okay, there are people who look like me, even though we all don't have the same exact experience or belief, we do have a shared history.
Yes.
In that way. And we do have some shared current experiences as you talk about, you know, the disparities in healthcare. So we don't even, as you said, we don't have to think about historical events in the here and now. I'm in Missouri and there was a case of a gentleman who during this COVID time, he went with his wife to try to be admitted to the hospital three separate times and they would not admit him and he died on the parking lot. So, you know, people say, well, how do you know it was racism? Which again is a microaggression and an invalidation, but we understand the differences. Why was he turned away? You know, his race and ethnicity, you know, the area in which he lives, the zip code, all of these being a part of the bias that sometimes people see us and they start to develop a certain belief about our disease, disorder, or whatever may be happening. So it's important for us to recognize even in current times, as you mentioned, there's a lot that's happening. But I do encourage our BIPOC community to look into what's happening in terms of research. If you are concerned with dominant culture and research, try to look into what's happening. We have a lot of HBCUs that do researchers. We have a lot of BIPOC researchers in majority institutions, you know, so look into that because we need to be a part of it. So basically building a new model, because if even like with the BMI, the body mass index, it is not made for our body type. So almost anytime that I am weighed by a doctor, I'm going to be obese.
Yes, I'm obese.
Even if I'm active, even if I'm running marathons, because our body type is different. So I encourage my mental health patients, you know, with weight to say, you know, talk with your doctor, ask them to do a culturally type of adapted BMI. So those are things that we have to be aware of, you know, when we are working and advocating for our physical and our mental health.
Yes. Can I speak to the current challenges that we're still experiencing in healthcare? My wife is a physician and she delivers babies. She's an OB. Hey, hon. She was just sharing with me.
Shout out.
She was just sharing with me about how she has a patient who was really fearful of not working with her as a Black physician because of what she may experience if someone else doesn't understand her body, what she's going through. Mm-hmm. And she was sharing how she had mentioned to the other physicians, you know, her pain tolerance around having the child, some of her fears. And as she was mentioning to these other physicians, those things had actually not been looked at as closely. And as a result, I think she had to go in, end up having an emergency C-section because mm-hmm. no one really paid attention, right, to the things that she was really talking about. And so if you don't have individuals that mm-hmm. are culturally aware of what's happening, can mm-hmm. understand that just because I'm Black doesn't mean that my pain tolerance is different or I'm complaining about things. And so people need to understand that, right? Yes. Thankfully, my wife did, and then she was, you know, able to assist. But in other settings where you don't have that representation of people who understand your experience, those things often go, you know, unlooked and unfortunately cause lot more challenges than having mm-hmm. an emergency C-section.
Well, I'm thankful that woman had your wife as a physician, and we'll have a Black OBGY on next month. But as we said, systemic issues, access to care with Black women, three times more the maternal mortality rate. I had that experience myself too. You know, my husband had to advocate for me as well. And if you don't have someone there, also encouraging doulas, particularly African American doulas, to be there as well for support, because what is shared because of bias, the bias of, you know, oh, Black people have higher levels of pain tolerance, so they can handle it. Our skin is thicker. All of these myths that research shows that they have trained physicians and doctors and some, you know, being trained residents who were surveyed, and they had people who believed these myths. So that becomes the bias now when people interact with us that can put us at risk. Mm-hmm. And before we go on to our next question, I did not remember at the top of the hour to remind everyone that you can text in questions to our ITR and text questions at 682-710-1101. Again, that number is 682-710-1101. I'm sure with this topic, there would be a lot of great questions to ask. So now we can, before we started to decide on what we were going to discuss today, when I asked, well, what do you want to talk about, Dr. Meek? She said you had a 3-hour conversation with a Black student about his struggles in college and growing up in a poor urban environment. Talk with us a little bit more just about SES and housing and its impact on Black people. You mentioned it earlier, but if you could go into some more detail for us.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, SES, socioeconomic status, often involves three things. We probably think about it as economics or talk about it as economics only, right? But SES includes economics, education, and occupation. And the lack of adequate support can really have people feeling helpless. And so I did mention to you a conversation that I had with the student was a 3-hour conversation who was really struggling academically and in other areas of life. One of the things that I always share with students is I don't think that we, even as researchers, know the impact that COVID is really having on students or us in general, right? I think the research is still early. And so we don't quite know the effects that it's all having. Those things, COVID being those things, is really compounded, the effects is compounded when you are in a low income environment. So the student talks about the lack of support that he has, you know, from family members. They not really understanding the stress that he's experiencing. He wants to be able to do well, but doesn't feel like his family understands. He is a first generation college student, which a lot of individuals who come from low environments are.
I was first generation.
Right. And so there's a lot of stress that comes with that. The issues, you don't want to tell anyone that you're experiencing certain stress or maybe that you're not doing well academically. Your family may not understand. You don't even want to talk to your professors about it. You may not even want to talk to your Black professors about it. There's the stigma, a stigma about coming from a low SES environment. Mm-hmm. You're thinking that your professor's thinking that you might not want to excel well academically, or that you're just not trying hard enough, right? And so one is coming with all of that baggage. And so then it prevents them from asking for assistance early on in class. And so we talked about all of these things that he's experiencing. Mm-hmm. And what came up in that conversation is that he really needed to see a counselor or a mental health therapist as well, because he was experiencing a lot of increased stress due to some trauma. But because of the socialization messages, he didn't really want to seek counseling, right, at the school. And so that goes into a whole nother conversation. But there's a lot of stress that our Black and brown individuals are experiencing within school and other settings, but because of the trauma that they've experienced before, being first generation, and if you are at, like I am, a predominantly white university, then you really don't want to be the standout, right? You want to show that you can exceed and do just as well as anyone else. And so it creates a lot of different challenges that our experiences have. And while people are often proud of the numbers of minority students that you can bring into a school, I say, well, that's great, but how many of them actually graduate?
Yeah.
We need to be looking at not how many we bring in, but how many of them are actually matriculating through, you know, this system. And I think we've unfortunately not done the best work on that part.
It's a lot of stress. I mean, I can talk from my personal experience. I attended a HBCU for undergrad. Wonderful experience. See your professors, you know, admin, everyone looks like you just every day. It's great. Now, college is going to be stressful no matter what. You know, there's going to be like some probably adjustment disorder with anxiety and or depressed mood that can happen because it's a new space. But for people of color, for us, there's that. And then there's having to deal with racism, right? So I had that buffer of the HBCU in that I didn't have to think of all that for undergrad. And, you know, I excelled. I was able to do everything. And then when I got to dominant, you know, majority school for grad, it is a totally different feeling, as you say. And it's exhausting. Your student, there was his metacognition thinking about his thinking. It was exhausting just thinking, hearing you talk about it, right? But that is our experience. And usually you're correct. There isn't a space. And even in going to like the counseling center that is there for students, there's that stigma. Are people going to think because I come from a poor neighborhood that I can't cut it? Is it because I'm Black and from a poor neighborhood that it's not going to happen? So it's important to recognize how we can decrease that stigma. You talked about a lot of intersectionality there. Recently, Dr. Williams was on and she talked about the intersection between religion and race. You know, we've talked about a lot of different intersections. So now you just brought up SES, but also gender. You do a lot of work with Black men. So talk with us about the intersection of race and gender, particularly Black men seeking mental health services.
Yeah, I think, thank you for that question, to talk about the intersectionalities of lots of different things, right? And so when thinking about, though, being male and Black, there are these racial socialization messages. And when thinking about being a male has to act a certain way, right? Not that these things are necessarily true, but a man cannot show his emotions outwardly. He is to be strong and to act as if nothing can affect him. Right, right. And so your heart, nothing affects you. You have this belief that you don't even have emotion, right? I don't know where that comes from. And so that's just the male part. The Black part of that is, you being Black, you don't see a therapist. That's something that white people do, right? These are messages that we hear.
Yeah.
And so often, if that is the case, then what we as people of color want to do, we want to move as far away from doing things that the dominant group often does. And so then we don't seek the therapy that we need or mental health counseling. We may not even seek the physical help that we need to go to a doctor because we're strong. I can take pain, right? All of these things that are associated with being male and Black. And we see that in our numbers. Often it's because of our Black women. So thank you, Black women. Thank you, wife. Thank you, mom, who encourages the Black men to even go to the doctor, right? To see the doctor. And so a lot of those things show up because of the messages that have been detrimental to us. And these messages, once again, are passed down from generation to generation.
And you talked about a lot there just in terms of masculinity stereotypes, right? And just this, but I always, you know, I use the analogy of if you don't bend, you'll break. And within our community, we, in some aspects of our community, we see so much violence. And that's the reason, like anything that is perceived as some level of disrespect, it escalates to violence. And why? Because of shoes, because of an outfit, because somebody looked at you the wrong way, because we have come so far in some areas in terms of being able to communicate with each other, to realize the Ubuntu, that, you know, I am, because we are like being connected in that way. So I have worked with a lot of Black men, and that's something. And it's not all, sometimes there is still the concern. I've had Black male clients who had concerns of working with Black women because of those stereotypes, because there have been Black women who say, well, oh, well, you can't be soft. You can't cry. You can't show these kind of things. So then it serves as a corrective emotional experience, having a space and where they can be vulnerable and have a balanced set of emotions. Emotions aren't bad or good. Dr. Williams was just on and, you know, she talked about it's not positive or negative. Emotions are there to tell us something is going on. And we have to ask ourselves, okay, why am I thinking that way? Why am I feeling that way? What's going on? But why am I angry?
Yeah,
that's do I feel more so disappointed. And because I'm disappointed, it's manifesting as anger. Is it sad? Is it depressed? Is it feeling not valued? Is it feeling worthless? So there's so much anger in our community, which is a part of that post-traumatic slave syndrome, that we really just have to dig deeper into in terms of like what else is going on.
Yeah, I love that. I talk about two things really been important in our development and things that we really need to consider. It's our internal and then our external. And I believe that our external is often a manifestation of what's happening internal, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is something that often shows up, say, in school for Black boys, where Black boys often get in trouble, that trouble being external because of maybe being more aggressive, not being able to sit down, different things like that. But it's because of something that's going on internal that has them to act out a certain way external. And then according to research, there are actually, and then the conversation that we just had about emotions, there's mm-hmm. something different with our Black females or females in general, because females express themselves differently emotionally, mm-hmm. where they don't often get in trouble with the acting out, right? Or being aggressive. And so it's really important that we really think about emotions and yes. how we deal with emotions and how things do play themselves out externally because mm-hmm. of what's going on internally.
Exactly. So that's socialization. We talked about socialization with race, but we also have it with gender, that sometimes there's that stereotype that yes, girls can be sad and show their emotion, boys can't. So sometimes instead of feeling the sadness, right, aggression is acceptable yes. because that's considered more masculine. So you talked earlier about evidence-based treatments. You specialize in cultural education also of Black youth. Can you talk with us, Dr. Mace, about your nonprofit organization, Anidaso 360, and the inspiration behind it?
Yeah, thank you for allowing me to talk about this, which I'm really passionate about, probably like everything else that I just said. But Anidaso means hope, or to be hopeful in a Ghanaian language of tree. And I'll start with the inspiration. In 2014, I was working in the public schools in which I live here as a restorative justice practitioner. And so I have many, many stories of parents that I've encountered, as well as students that I've encountered that have some behavioral challenges and, you know, was in some ways either biased or just feeling like, man, we must do better. But a part mm-hmm. of it was really complaining. And so I went to a friend's and I was sharing all of my stories about all of the things that are happening within the school and how we need to do this. And oh, this kid, that, and the mom came. Can you believe this? And mm-hmm. then he began to share his stories as he was working in the Indianapolis school system with low SES individuals. And then he was sharing his stories. And I said, okay, well, let's stop. Are we going to continue complaining about the issue or actually do something about it? Mm-hmm. And then he said, well, what are the two things that I believe have been transformative in my life? And so we actually concluded on two things. We said it was our faith and that it was the ability to be able to travel to the continent of Africa. Okay. And then we said, well, I think everybody needs that. Everybody needs to become attuned with their spiritual mm-hmm. ideas of self. And then they need to travel to the continent, specifically Black people, to understand who, you know, they are. And so we said, well, let's do it. And so that's what we did. We took a group of men to the continent of Africa, specifically Ghana, for 5 weeks, where we said it's going to be about them understanding their purpose in life and their identity and the fact that they can do and become whomever they want to be, and that that can show up for themselves professionally. And so that's what we did. And then wonderful. It was, as I mentioned, only males. And then, you know, the sisters got upset and was like, well, what about us? Although, you know, we knew that men, we felt like the men really needed to step up. But then we was like, okay, yeah. So we decided to then do a program called Sankofa 360. And Sankofa 360 which means to go back and get it. And I think that that's important. It's to go back and claim what is ours, right, from our continent, to claim our sense of identity,
yes,
who we are. And so we decided to do a co-ed trip for both men and women. These are career professionals, because most people weren't able to do the 5-week experience unless you were maybe college students. And so it's the same thing in mind, that we would educate, empower, and equip men and women of color spiritually, culturally, and professionally. Why the spiritual piece? The spiritual piece is because I really believe that our churches, not all of them, but if you're in the Christian faith, and maybe even other spaces as well, that our churches in our current day, they have divorced our Blackness from our spirituality. And we said, well, I can be both Black and Christian at the same time. I can care about what's happening in my community. I can move beyond this, oh, let's just pray about it. Like that just didn't work for us. We can pray and act at the same time. And so we wanted people to know that. And not only that, to move away from this Eurocentric idea of religion or Christianity.
Oh, say it again, Dr. Right? Me. Say it again. You talking my language. That's why you're here.
We need to look into that. That's why we see less churches, I believe, filled with younger people. They want something that's going to be relevant, that actually speaks to them, what's happening within their environment and community. And this Eurocentric way is just losing them, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's what
we've been prayer
doing.
Works. Although prayer works.
But absolutely.
You have to reach the people.
Yes.
Prayer works, but you have prayer to reach works. The people.
Absolutely. And so I agree. Prayer works. And so, as I mentioned, we must pray and act at the same time, right? And so we wanted to see that done. And so fortunately, we've been able to mobilize groups of people of African descent to the continent.
Wonderful.
For 10 days through our Sankofa experience. And it has just been transformative. It allows our people. And I do want to mention this. We have talked about, you and I have talked about the effects of historical trauma.
Yes.
Right. And for historical trauma, there are a lot of things that affect us based on the trauma that we've experienced historically. A couple of those things might include depression, you know, a lost sense of self.
Mm-hmm.
We have anger, sadness. Mm-hmm. And so those are some manifestations.
Inability to trust.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so all of those things are a result of the historical trauma. Well, what's great about connecting with a sense of self, our ancestral identity, is that it actually reverses those things. It will give us a sense of self, a sense of purpose. It lessens this sense of shame that we might have for ourselves and being able to communicate who we are to the dominant group or anyone else. It gives us, instead of feeling isolation, which is also a manifestation of historical trauma, it gives us a sense of belonging to our community, and it allows us to be able to see ourselves in a way in which we may not have seen ourselves before. And so it really helps to counter some of those effects of historical trauma. And so that's why I say it's powerful. And then the last thing I'll say on this is, we don't just do trips. I mean, that's not what we do.
That's not what you do. Yeah.
Not at all. And so we really do what we believe is a cultural immersive experience.
Yes.
I went to the continent in 2007, I think, for the first time. And because of the nature of that trip, and it was transformative, we actually didn't connect with who we were as Black people. And that was a huge miss.
Yes.
And I believe that it needed to be intentional. We needed to understand who we were while we were there. And now I got some of that just as a result of being there for the first time. But it can be so much more transformative when we are actually helping people to understand who they are in the space that they have come from, right? Or that their ancestors have come from. And so that's what a little bit about what Anidaso is. Our mission is to drive social change through cultural emergent experiences to strengthen the collective well-being of people of color. And we envision that these communities and that these people's lives will be transformed, that they will make a meaning impact as global leaders and citizens.
Wonderful. Thank you. Well, we're going to have you back, and Mr. Tim Swain, also your partner in Anidaso, to talk more about that. But I agree, as a psychologist, I often talk about, you know, holistic healing, meaning it's mind, body, and spirit. So psychotherapy may be one part, but I do believe what you said there, that there has to be that contact, like the soul, the psyche has to reconnect. And because we were stolen and taken to so many other parts of the world, and we were indoctrinated into a fundamentalist, Eurocentric type of Christianity, that's what sometimes we still suffer from now. So what you mentioned, that you can be Black and Christian, is true, because Christianity existed on the continent before.
Absolutely.
Europeans came there, but the way in which it was weaponized to keep us passive and dependent in that type of way, it worked against us. So what you talked about there, definitely connecting with that cultural aspect, that within itself is healing. Like, psychotherapy is important for like types of traumas, depression, anxiety, but when like causation is that lack of identity of self, of who one is, there has to be that connection. So we will have you back to definitely talk more about that.
Yeah, and I'll make this quick. I think that we do ourselves and our children a disservice when we teach them as if our history started here in the U.S. One,
there you
we
go.
Are not slaves. We were enslaved people.
There
and
you
so
go.
That is a condition, not who we are.
Exactly.
And we must teach them that our enslaved ancestors, our ancestors who were enslaved, they were people. They had families.
Yes.
They had culture, community, right? And so we really need to start
and created civilization, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, we created everything. Science.
We were the first.
Technology,
right?
The first.
And all, yes.
Exactly. University, all of that. So I agree. That's what I teach my daughter. So we definitely have to have you talk back to talk more about that. But we do have one question, and I want to try to get to that before we wrap up. The question is, the topic of representation is paramount for minority groups. I have experienced trauma and compounded trauma, PTSD, as a result of therapy, accessibility, the red tape, and insurance acceptance. Trauma brain, foggy brain is real. How can you recover, retain your brain from this? Where to seek help?
Great question. There's a lot in there. Thank you.
And we only have 3 minutes, so we will to definitely hit the highlights.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I really believe is that we have to combat lies, right? Combat those lies. And so how do we combat those lies? One of those things, as we've just talked about, is really knowing and understanding who we are, right? Understanding who we are as people. Our cultural and ancestral background, I think, really helps to resolve a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing, yes, the effects of PTSD. Now, there's something, if we are continually experiencing trauma, we didn't get to this conversation. I don't like to continue to use that P as post. It's a continual stress, right, that we're experiencing.
Ongoing stress.
It's ongoing. And for my research, I usually talk about it as urban traumatic stress. But I think quickly, it really is about engaging and re-engaging with who you really are, with your true ancestral identity, because there's pride in that. And often the messages that we receive aren't very exciting, right? It would tell you that you are a slave, and then that will make you feel some kind of way, right? Or that you're not smart. You are academically inferior. Well, all
or
those
deficient.
Things that I'm saying, right, are lies.
Yes.
And so we need to understand who we are, know that we are great, not because we just say that we are, but because our ancestors are great. And if we are here, this is powerful. If we are here because of what our ancestors have endured, we are the strongest people
that
have ever
it.
Survived.
Resilient. There you go.
All the things that they've experienced. And we are here because our ancestors made it here. They went through a lot. We are strong people. So let's connect with who we are and really understanding the truths of our ancestors and all that they have contributed. I think that will really help to lessen the stress, the PTSD, and other things that we're experiencing.
Excellent response. And post-traumatic growth. We often talk about post-traumatic stress. So post-traumatic growth. Also areas in where you can find help. The Association of Black Psychologists is listed on the ITRN radio site. We have free emotional emancipation circles and Sabwana healing circles for racial healing. Also InnoPsych, Dr. Charmaine Jackman. She has been a guest. She also provides specific work. Thank you to Dr. Roe Meeks for being here today on New Horizon, the Mind and Body Connection. We appreciate you. Thank you so much. You'll definitely have to come back to share more with us.
Yeah, first, thank you so much for the opportunity. If anyone is interested, they can email me at meeksrom@msu.edu. And if anyone who is listening is interested in Anidaso more specifically, they can look at our website. It's just Anidaso, A-N-I-D as in David, A-S-O, 360.com. And you can check out our documentary. If you go to YouTube, just, you know, put in the Anidaso 360 story.